I'm Christopher Lighton with an open source sidebar on the hour we spent with Noam Chomsky. The man has had two giant careers, one in the science of language, another in the rough and tumble of anti-war politics. And there's always been a question, is it one Chomsky or two? I was hoping to locate the larger idea or human impulse that drives the stubborn peacenik and the father of modern linguistics. You can feel some of the answer in Chomsky's voice and his presence, but we got outside clarification too from his biographer, Robert Barsky, who has puzzled through the Chomsky links over the years and talked with Chomsky about them. I asked Robert Barsky to lay out the foundational principles of Chomsky's thought, first about language acquisition and then about power.
If you look to his early work and his work on Cartesian linguistics, you realize that it comes out of a few principal basic insights. The first one is that we are not machines, that we don't learn on the basis of a blank slate, that we don't learn language the way that we learn other things, the evidence being that very young children say things that they have never heard before, and they learn their first language remarkably rapidly, which would suggest that we have the equipment already present in our brains to produce, understand human language from birth. Any human being who is subjected even to the smallest amount of linguistic input is able to create a very complex and rich linguistic world.
But it's different then from walking or dancing or fighting.
It's different and it's not. He talks about it as an organ, but I think even more interestingly is a deferred ability, such as sexuality. We are clearly sexual beings. We're endowed with the propensity, proclivity, and so forth for sexuality. It makes itself manifest at 12 years old or 13 years old, 14 years old later on, but it's already present. So it is a natural ability. On the other hand, it's also affected by the context within which it is made manifest. So in that sense, interestingly, although we're more or less identical, we're also all different because our endowment will react with the environment around it.
Robert, test Chomsky theory with a simple little impossible example. Two infants who've never heard language wash up on a desert island and grow up together.
Yep.
Do they talk?
No. They would have to have natural language input. And interestingly, all natural languages emerge from universal grammar. And therefore, although Japanese is undeniably different from English in so many ways, it has certain attributes that can be noted early on, and this suggesting that they all emerge from the same source, no matter how different they are as an epiphenomenon. But if you try to teach a kid a computer language, for example, as his basic or her basic language, it's learned differently. So this suggests that there is also something like natural languages, and you'd have to be exposed to natural languages.
Robert Barsky, do the same for Noam Chomsky as a social critic, analyst of media, anti-war spokesman so consistently, 50 years and more.
Absolutely. I think that on the one hand, he's an incredibly important institutional thinker. Chomsky understands individuals' relationships to institutions, the way that institutions can become masters or dominant over individuals and limit their capacity, their proclivity, but also an institutional thinker in terms of the ways in which people could manifest their creative selves if they were able to resist hegemonic, powerful institutions that try to control them. So Chomsky's work resists existing structures that are in their nature power-based, that try to advance the interests of some over others. And therefore, if you look at, for example, his media analysis, if you look at his social analysis, it's about people making their own decisions. It's about people making up their own minds. It's about people having control over the decisions that they make. And he will also suggest in any number of realms that he talks about the ways in which the powerful try to limit our natural proclivity towards creative thinking, towards creative decision making in their own interest. So media colludes logically with other powers because media is owned by other powers. Media represents other powers. Whenever you have, for example, a corporate structure in which the institution is to benefit from a profit motive, it is in their interest to provide a particular worldview that advances their interests as opposed to providing the information that people can use to become actors in their own social setting. So the ideal media is a media that provides information that allows people to make their own decisions about their lives, about their futures, about what it is that they are themselves interested in. A negative version of the media is a media that manipulates them, a media that distracts them, diverts them, and puts them onto ideas that will not help them better understand the world, but instead turn them into, say, good consumers of what it is that the media wants them to consume.
Robert, you mentioned so many predecessors going back to Socrates, literally, and Plato,
yes,
and Descartes, and Gramsci, and the moderns, yeah, Bertrand Russell, you didn't mention, but sort between the ancestors, so to speak, and the real influences. Where does he come from when people ask you?
It's so fascinating to read his work because his work is a gateway into the thought of, as you say, individuals dating back to Plato and Aristotle and so forth. I think that all of those influences are crucial. He names a few as being central, such as Bertrand Russell. I would add as being absolutely central the work of Rudolf Rocker, the German anarchist, Wilhelm von Humboldt, a philosopher, especially in his early work. But on the other hand, Chomsky is so profoundly connected to communities, alternative communities, scientific communities, and so forth, that he not only advances ideas that are historically rooted, but he also situates them in regards to particular contexts. So it's very exciting to read his work as a gateway into a vast liberal arts education, both in terms of the scientific work on language and in terms of the social analysis that he does. So this leads us into anarchism, anarcho-syndicalism, classical liberalism, small c conservatism, all of these things from the Scottish Enlightenment to Barcelona in the 1930s. He helps us to understand those notions, but he also helps us to understand the small local communities that are battling power and trying to understand their own place in the world. And as such, although the ideas are vast and gigantic, they're also situated very, very locally.
People like to see two Chomskys, Robert. I try to imagine one, synthesizing the scientific impulse to explain how language makes babies human incredibly fast, but also in the peacenik side of his social activism, how we're missing something in our language to preserve the species for all time. Is there any uniting these two impulses?
There are two answers, one of them that he gives, which is that they are two different realms, one of them scientific, demanding a huge engagement with the specific scientific literature relating to language. The other one, in a sense, applying what he calls common sense, a kind of Cartesian common sense, a kind of Orwellian openness, kind of fact-finding in order to help understand the world. I have discussed this with him a lot and suggested that, in fact, there are very interesting points in which the two come together. One of them is his resistance to those powers and ideas that are imposed upon us. One of the first letters that he ever wrote to me, I summon up the courage to write to the great Noam Chomsky, who it seems a little bit like getting into a time machine, and as a lover of literature, writing to Charles Dickens, I write to him, and I'm considering as I'm writing the letter, is it dear professor, is it dear doctor, is it dear sir? And he writes back and says the titles are tiresome, and I will not use one that is associated with you if you will not use one associated with me. That somehow that's a way to bring us down to earth so that we can have a real conversation. And that, I think, is a nugget of really important knowledge about him. You've often heard, I'm in academia, I often hear something like, well, he's got a doctorate, he must be smart. that kind of idea is the first thing that's discarded in Chomsky's work. So you look at things as they are, you meet people as they come at you, you encounter notions as they're presented, and you analyze them as such. You don't say, because it was done by the military, it must be right. Because it was a scientist that did it, the data must be non-corrupt, and so forth and so on. It's like it lifts the veil that makes us intimidated to go after knowledge. It lifts that veil and says to you, you have the driver's license to actually engage with society, to engage with scientific ideas, and not be fearful that because you don't have so-and-so accreditation, you're not allowed to look at it. And that's why his biography is so important. His own biography says, I am going to look at the work of Skinner. If the work of Skinner seems to me to be counterintuitive or wrong historically or scientifically ungrounded, I'm a young man. I've looked at the data. I'm going to do a review in the New York Review of Books, and I'm going to take on one of the greatest figures of the period, and I'm going to descend his ideas in the flames that he descended them into, because they're simply not right according to the paradigm that I have carefully, respectfully, and intensely examined. I think that that's an incredible liberation for all of us.
Explain his connection with real people. I mean, literally everybody. They come into his office. It's a religious view. He wouldn't say God's children, or he probably wouldn't even say these are divine creatures, but these are absolutely equal in their worthiness in the long run. How does he come to this view, and how does he communicate it? Which he does.
At the end of the day, so much of Noam Chomsky's work is about power. It's about those people who are in power, those people who are disempowered, those people who are seeking power, those people who are outside of the realm of seeking power. What he does in his writing is he sets forth ideas that resonate with us because they're carefully, respectfully described. He says things that we almost blush, and I would argue that we often laugh when we hear him describe a politician as being a commissar or Stalinist. It's funny. And in laughing, we form a relationship with Noam because he's taking on the Kissingers and the Trumps and the Stalins and the Lenins and so forth, and he's describing them for the ideas that they are promoting and for the people that they're massacring and murdering and obliterating and making disappear. It's an incredible ability that I think we all, at the end of the day, admire, unless we are betrothed to that power. So whether it be somebody in a poor neighborhood, whether it be somebody who has thought deeply about what it means to raise a child and all of a sudden encounters Noam Chomsky's work about children and says, my goodness, that resonates with my own experience, and then feels like his work is a gateway into thinking not only what we've thought, but maybe thinking about these things in regards to much broader and more complex ideas.
In the end, see him as one for us, the one Noam Chomsky, this institution. Nobody quite like him. Two very opposite fields, and we didn't even mention that, you know, his time, some say, has gone, come and gone in a very significant way, but he would argue that he didn't do enough in politics.
Yep.
He
Absolutely.
Left too much undone. Imagine this man approaching 90, self-consciously, alert, cheerful, incredibly accessible. Is there a way to see him in one frame, Robert?
You know, I am one of a multitude, a horde of people who have found another education by reading Chomsky's work. So in that regard, he's been a catalyst to figure things out by yourself, to understand what it means to make decisions on the basis of the knowledge that you've acquired. He is an absolute model of unimaginable generosity, generosity of thought, generosity of spirit. But also, I think that this rejection of the honors that people are offered as kind of smokescreens to reality, that's something that I love about Noam. He has realized that in connecting truly with communities and truly with individuals. And the question for him becomes, how do we catalyze that profound ability that everybody has? Because if power is in the business of teaching us how to be good consumers, if power is in the business of keeping us down, if power is in the business of teaching us how to vote against our own best interests, then what is the opposite? The opposite is, and this is consistent with people like Humboldt, the opposite is, how do you promote creativity? How do you promote people's ability to think for themselves? How do you promote people's understanding of their connection to the people around them in ways that are going to benefit themselves and their environment, as opposed to just allow them to have more power? That, I think, is at the very heart of Noam Chomsky linguistically, in terms of academics, and in terms of his social thought.
Can you imagine Noam Chomsky's vision of a much better future that's attainable?
I think that one of the great revelations that one has in meeting people for the first time is to find out how many hidden abilities they have, both abilities that they know about and abilities that they don't know that they have. And I mean abilities writ large. It's so fascinating to sit on a subway, look at the people around you and think, what are these people capable of doing? And what are the things that they don't even realize that they're capable of doing? I think that the greatest society for Noam Chomsky would be a society in which people's amazing abilities would be made manifest. And one of the characteristics of the anarchist, for example, Rudolf Rocker, who I take to be such an important precedent, is that you ostensibly believe that people in their hearts are interested in collaboration. They're ostensibly good. We live in a society in which people are told that everything is dangerous, people are dangerous, that creativity is dangerous, and so forth. This is exactly the opposite. You have these incredible possible abilities, these incredible possible strengths, without power impeding our ability to explore ideas. The great society would be the one that would allow us to explore them, to develop them, and come up with things, as he did as a young man, as a young researcher in language, that were against the existing powers, but that turned out to be, well, quote unquote, right. And that's what I think is exciting also, that inside of you, you have this unbelievable, untapped potential, and power is in the business of keeping us down. Chomsky's in the business of catalyzing that power towards social good, environmental awareness, and an understanding of what people are capable of in the good society.
Robert Barsky, thank you.
Thank you so very much for calling me.
Robert Barsky teaches law and literature at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. 20 years ago, he wrote Noam Chomsky, A Life of Dissent. And after that, the Chomsky Effect, the radical works beyond the ivory tower. So there's your cue to go back to the full Chomsky Effect that we got in a long conversation with him at radioopensource.org. Thanks to Connor Gillies for recording Robert Barsky and to Becca DiGregorio for editing him. Do visit our website for lots more conversations, videos, and features. You can subscribe to our podcasts and sign up for our newsletter at radioopensource.org. Thanks to all our listeners for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project. I'm Christopher Lydon.